Coming up in today's Ideaspace podcast.
I think if you are a founder, you are everything to begin with. You know, your finance, your marketing, and your people. I just wouldn't underestimate the importance of the people agenda early on. You and I can only do 100% of what we're capable of doing. But if you want the multiplier effect, you need people around you, right? And you, and the people around you, it's the uniqueness of the individuals around and that configuration. But it's, first of all, attracting them to your idea.
Welcome to the Ideaspace podcast. I'm Ben Hartley, head of Ideaspace. Ideaspace is a community of entrepreneurs, founders and their teams, many of them working alongside each other in one of our three offices based in and around Cambridge. Our members share knowledge, experience and expertise to help themselves and others in their high-impact venture creation. Today, I'm speaking with Alex Niklaus, the people and culture leader at Paysend, who has worked with both corporates and fast-growing startups across different industries in Europe, China and across Asia. Alex has helped these businesses to attract, retain and develop exceptional talent while creating unique workplace cultures by working closely with the CEO and executive leadership team across the full spectrum of people and culture. In today's podcast, we'll look into what makes founders and entrepreneurs tick, learn how startups can build high-performing people and culture teams from scratch, and also hear about some of the failures aspiring CEOs make along the way. Importantly, we'll also look at ways founders can manage stress, deal with setbacks, and hear about tips to help maintain a work-life balance whilst running a startup. Well, Alex, thank you very much for joining us today. It's great to have you here. We're currently in the West Hub in West Cambridge recording this, and Alex has kindly joined us in person, which is brilliant. Right, before we mine your vast experience for some great stories and some valuable insight, I thought it'd be great to find out a little bit more about you and your own experiences, because you've got a really interesting kind of backstory and starting out with the fact that you're German, but you were raised in France and you were educated in the UK. How did that come about? Does your family travel a lot?
Thank you for having me. It's timely background, especially with the European Football Championships coming up, because I can really back three countries, Germany, France and England.
Right,
so excellent. Out of the three, you know, I have a good chance of, you know, being there in the final. It's a very eclectic international background. Originally from Germany, grew up in France, went to an English school in France because the French system was a bit too hard, and then ended up studying in the UK. And because of my background, I think naturally I didn't want to settle, and I was always open for either changing locations. And it just so happens that I met my now wife, at the time girlfriend, very early on, just after university. And from there, we traveled, you know, across Asia and Europe. And I guess that's probably also why, you know, I changed jobs 8-9 times throughout my 20 years, just because, you know, I always wanted to do something a bit different.
And the fact you've ended up with people and culture, and you've met people and culture from all over the world, or different cultures as well, that has obviously helped inspire you as well. And speaking of inspiration, so what inspired you to undertake your degree in international management and business? Had you always thought of sort of a career in business, and what sort of sparked that interest?
And Reading University was actually the only university that gave me a place.
Okay, great.
And also they had a very good tennis program, because at the time I was heavily into tennis, which I then pursued in China as well. Actually ending up doing a TV ad for Heineken in China because of the tennis, and following, you know, my wife to China. So you never know where something ends up.
Yeah,
but to come back to the original question, not really. I didn't exactly know what I wanted to do. So I think the safe option is, if you do want to go to university, and it's something I tell my own children and others, is you just pick something which, you know, gives you more options afterwards. So the international management was just something quite vanilla to begin with.
Yeah. And then you ended up in talent and executive recruitment in London, and before you moved to Beijing. So tell us how that sort of hop went.
Yeah, I think once you leave university, you try as best as possible to replicate some of the skills you have learned at university, which is research. And I think when I began as a research associate within an executive search firm, it was just a natural progression. I didn't end up on any graduate schemes. And funnily enough, after a couple of years doing research, I got a little bit bored, just because there wasn't enough interaction. I was quite good with numbers, but not the best at looking at numbers, or just piling research reports, and I just wanted to be more on the people side. And I think that's where I transitioned to actually interviewing, meeting candidates, understanding how clients were looking at filling their key positions, but always as a consultant, never in-house, which is where I transitioned afterwards.
Okay. And then obviously, you've been in a corporate environment, and then you moved into more of the startup scene, I guess you'd call it that, in Singapore. So, I mean, these are already quite substantial moves. So what led you to kind of abandon the safety and security of a corporate world into that of something a lot more exciting and unpredictable as the world of startups?
But it was very much down to progression and self-development. I think anyone who can should, for a couple of years, work for a bigger corporation or big organization, just because there's great things to learn and to soak in. So for me, I had, the first part of my career was consulting, and then I moved into the bigger corporates across different industries and different countries. But then I had an allergic reaction to one of the big consultancy firms. I had nothing against the organization themselves, but just the setup didn't work for me. So rather than do a 360 and end up in the same place and just join a similar organization, I decided, hey, let's do 180 and just go the completely opposite direction, and ended up with Grab Taxi, which is now Grab, and a $50 billion valuation company that only started 12 years ago.
Wow. And you started, so what was your position, and how did you actually find that position?
Well, I wrote directly to the two co-founders. My advice for anyone always when they want to look for the next or their first job or their next career move is to be quite proactive if they can. So I just wrote to them and highlighted what I could do for them. And sort of, funnily enough, they wrote back. But the funny story there is that I met both of them in a warehouse in the middle of nowhere in Singapore. And for me, I was waiting, to meet two Harvard grads who decided to drop everything and to do this this organization. And this taxi app was really to improve the safety and the convenience for consumers because they had some personal stories. And then I said to myself, look, if they can drop everything and don't need the title, don't need the money, although they had some funding and did that, why shouldn't I? So I started with them for the first sort of 6 to 8 months to help them with all of their key executive hires. And that gave me my first sort of flavor of, the limits are only to what I set them. And quickly I was able to, in the space of 8 years, fast forward to now, move from just doing the executive search for one startup to becoming a chief people officer. And that comes down to, your own drive. But the startup world has very little limitations in terms of what you want to do. Whereas I think with bigger organizations, bigger corporates, it's the job architecture is in place. If you want to progress and want to be a lifer, you have to do those years. Whereas in startups, there's more ambiguity, but it's down to you really in terms of how much you want to get done and how quickly, which fits my personality a bit more when you come back to the original question of, moving countries, always wanting a bit of change and not having the fear of failure and so forth.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. I think being that the majority of members at Ideaspace, we've got a lot of listeners who are actually working on their own ventures, but also listeners interested in entrepreneurship in general. I thought it'd be quite interesting to try and dive into the minds of those entrepreneurs and see what makes them tick. Do you think there are common traits that are shared amongst entrepreneurs?
So out of the three that I've worked for, there was definitely a couple of traits that they all have. And then just generally being interested in the startup space and looking at other organizations, I can see them again. I think that the first one is they all have a very clear vision of what they want to solve. So they all see a problem somewhere. And if you ask any founder, there's always a frustration somewhere, or they've seen something that doesn't work. I'm sure we can use the word disruption, but it doesn't always mean they have to disrupt. But they always see something that isn't working or can be improved that others don't. Because if everybody would see it, then we wouldn't have so many founders or so many startups that are establishing themselves. So I would say out of the three I've worked with and others, they're very clear in terms of what they want to do, so the why and the vision. And most importantly, they can all see the problem they want to solve. So that for me is one trait that they all have. More specifically, in terms of behaviors, a huge amount of resilience. And I wouldn't say, sometimes the connotation is more around self-confidence, but I would more say it's around resilience, that, you know, they're very stoic about the high highs and they're very stoic about the low lows, but they just continue, you know, step after step, because coming back to my earlier point, they have a very clear vision and they don't deviate from it. That also has some negatives sometimes in terms of, you know, accepting other people's opinions or, you know, seeing things through a different lens. But that's also their strength, because they're so focused on something that they do get there at the end. So it's finding that little right balance, I would say. And the third trait is they bring people along, because you can't do it on your own. I mean, you and I can only do 100% of what we're capable of doing. But if you want the multiplier effect, you need people around you, right? And you, and the people around you, it's the uniqueness of the individuals around and that configuration. But it's, first of all, attracting them to your idea. But if you don't have the clear vision, and if you don't have that resilience that brings people along to say, okay, I'm going to follow Ben or I'm going to follow Alex with their idea, it's very hard to then scale globally if you don't have that clarity and can convince people, this is what I'm trying to do. You know, for us at Paysend, it's to solve financial inclusion. You know, we feel that too many individuals across the globe don't have access to financial services at an affordable price, you know, and at convenience and secure, right? That's what we're trying to solve. And we convince people to come with us on that sort of a journey, but that mission that we have. So I think that's what founders are also very good at. And to, the third trait is to bring people along, sell them this idea, and then retaining them. It's not easy. I mean, we can all join somewhere, but then it's keeping individuals with you over the years. And I've seen the successful founders, the founding team is still with them until there's like a big exit, and then everybody does their own sort of, you know, their own thing.
Yeah, because it's at the point that they grow and build a team that you often see them fail. So the idea can be great, and you don't need the team. You need a founder or co-founders and a great idea and a vision and people to come on board. But the moment or the key point that might decide whether a company is going to succeed or fail often comes when that initial team comes and the team's built. So,
no, absolutely. I mean, they do say 90% of startups fail. And I think top three is lack of funding, you know, money's run out or product market fit isn't right. I personally would put number one, and I'm a bit biased, it's the people aspect. If you don't have a people strategy or you don't know type of people you want, you bring in the wrong people, and then, you know, you're stuck with, you know, the wrong configuration. So if you can think about early enough, if we're very specific around the sort of the people agenda, is making sure that you are crystal clear about the kind of individuals you want with you, and then making sure that you can keep them with you, right? So, and that's hard work.
And in terms of risk, can you have an entrepreneur that is risk averse, do you think? Or
I think most successful ones have a high risk tolerance. And that's because I think a lot of them accept the downside in a lot of their decisions early on. So what I've seen, and it's a framework that I use a lot and that I've learned in the last three startups that I've been in, is sort of having a framework to mitigate against your fears in advance. So any decision we take is we try to figure out what's the downside. And if you're comfortable with the downside, whether it's a loss of money or, you know, a loss of time because you wanted to invest in R&D, for example, but if you're comfortable with that, then it doesn't matter, because even if you do get to that point, you knew it was going to happen, potentially, and then you just take the learnings, and it comes back to the resilience. I mean, I've failed projects many, many times, but because the failure was known in advance, it was no surprise. So there was no like telling off. It's like, oh yeah, we knew this was going to happen. You just, you know, spent, you know, 200,000 on a marketing campaign. It generated nothing, but we knew it would not generate something, or potentially, let's learn from it. So there's a high level of acceptance around that.
Yeah. And on that, you mentioned, you know, if there are failures, how do successful entrepreneurs handle or deal with failures and setbacks?
I think that the ones who have been around a little bit longer deal with it better. I think the younger founders, you know, who need to prove themselves a little bit more, either because they need to raise, you know, the next round, or they haven't really done an exit with their business, perhaps I've seen have less tolerance for failure, although they should, but because they come probably from a very high achieving environment, either consultancy or they come from academia, and they've always succeeded in whatever they touched, right? But then when you come into the world of startups, where you have externals, whether it's influencers, PR, investors who you don't can't always control or have different opinions, or also individuals who want to work for you, it's very difficult to control. And that's also where the acceptance of failure is a bit lower, and they get a bit irritated. But that's equally where a chief people officer comes in and can mitigate and can be counseling around friction points that might occur. Clearly, some more experienced founders have seen it and are a little bit more, not casual, but more accepting that, you know, after the rain, there's always sunshine, right? But they have a bit more experience in that.
Interesting. I'd quite like to stick on failures. Actually, it sounds like quite a negative thing to talk about. But, you said so many companies do fail. And it's not just the company failing, but within that journey upwards for those successful companies, it's littered with constant failures and setbacks. So it's an important thing to talk about, mainly because, especially the early stage, you learn so much from not just your own failures, but those around you as well. It's something that we find, you know, being a community of founders, you've got people working alongside each other who get to share those stories, and you learn from someone else's mistakes rather than yours is kind of useful. But what do you think are some of the most common reasons? I know you did touch on them for companies that fail early on, and I'm specifically aiming it at that because a lot of our members are very early stage founders. So less so when you've got a bigger team, but very early on.
I would say the product market fit.
Yeah, you touched on that earlier. So, yeah.
It's an important one because although I did say founders, so those are the traits in terms of having a very clear vision, having the resilience to pursue that vision and bringing the right people along, it doesn't mean that all of that together is the formula for success, because you do have to have a retrospective of, you know, making sure that the idea you have and the problem you're trying to solve, it can still be that, but the product you're trying to offer or the how might have to adapt. So a lot of the time, a lot of money is spent on a product that is not fit because they either didn't do their research, either they didn't don't guess, go test, right? So I think that there's a lot of work that can be done, and you need to have the agility and be open-minded that although you still have the same journey and the same solution you want to solve, I mean, we still want to solve financial inclusion, but the way we do it has changed dramatically because of the markets we've been, the products we've tested, you know, the hypothesis we've had. And it's okay, right? But you can't be one in one. You can't just start off saying, okay, some have the golden ticket and it works. But, you know, most of the time, I would say, be open-minded to test your ideas and be able to change the how. You don't have to change the why, but change how and what you are doing by getting feedback from the customers. And that's sometimes missed. What are you trying to solve and for whom? And once you know that, you reverse engineer and go out and ask, have I actually solved something for the customer, right? And get that feedback. Because if you haven't, then although you think that person needs this extra feature, if they don't give you the feedback that I would pay the extra premium, then you haven't done anything, right? And that's where stubbornness sometimes, and that's the flip side of what I was talking about earlier, right? That focus, that resilience, you got to still have that adaptability a little bit in order to, you know, change course correct.
Mm. And in terms of maybe some notable failures or examples of, are there any that you might be able to sort of touch on that we can learn from?
Yeah, so from the businesses I've worked in specifically, there was one when I worked for an MVNO, which is like a telco operator. And I think we had assumed that in the Taiwanese market, you know, they would not use, you know, a certain amount of, you know, bandwidth in terms of 4G without being too specific. And we gave huge promotional codes because we hadn't done our research on how the Taiwanese market is very different to the Singapore market. Although it's Asia, it's very different, and they wouldn't utilize, you know, the 100 gigabyte, you know, allowance we would give them. And we thought, well, it's a great promotion, like bait click to get them to join, and they'll use 5, and they've overused, and we lost a lot of money. And that was just it sounds like a very basic example, but it was, you know, real money. And startups most of the time don't achieve profitability very quickly. So the money you invest or the money you put towards marketing is investors' money. And you do need a return on investment. So unless you're fortunate to be in a phase where there's a lot of money out there and you can raise, you know, huge amounts of money now, you need to justify that much more. And that's why a lot of startups fail, because there's a lack of funding, because the product market fit wasn't right. The investors go, well, clearly you don't know what you're trying to solve. We're not giving you any more money. And then people leave. And then you might have had a great idea, but you missed it on that. So that would be one where we misunderstood the consumers, although we thought we knew them. And there's still microcultures even within the continent, for example. I think the other was at Paysend. And, you know, I think my boss or the team wouldn't mind me saying so. But again, it is thinking that children needed a Paysend account and needed to manage money and because of financial literacy and so forth. But again, we invested a huge amount of money on marketing, on targeting, you know, that age group, but it never reached them. It only reached the parents. Right. And the parents weren't really that interested in giving them access to those accounts. So again, that's just an example where, you know, we wanted to solve something. You know, deep down, it's probably a great idea for children to have a bit of financial literacy and have access.
Seems so, yeah.
But the marketing of how we're going to convert them didn't happen because they couldn't download the app anyway.
Yeah.
So again, that's where different areas don't speak to each other, right? But that's the quick... We could have spent longer in planning, and sometimes you do, but equally, the longer you plan, markets change, so you do have to try, put some money against it, see what happens, and then learn from it to a certain degree. But again, understand the downside framework, as I mentioned earlier.
It's interesting how, you know, looking at entrepreneurs and how they understand, or we all understand, that failures will be a part of that journey, but how does one sort of mitigate against that risk as much as possible, where you have to be agile and able to change, now able to take risks? But how does one best mitigate against it? And I know a lot of it's in planning and research, etc. But it must be very hard for small teams and individual founders. You just got one or two people often in startups. There's not that many people to bounce ideas off and to seek advice. How best do they do that?
So I think, although there might be limitations in your immediate team, you know, but even if you are 2, 3, 4 of you, make sure that there is some degree of diversity. I know there's a magnet towards, let's say, if I started my own company, maybe I want 3 other German fellas, you know, to join, and that would probably be the most convenient and maybe the easiest, and if it sounds the more familiar. But there would be loads of blind spots if we did that, right? But equally, so if you can't achieve diversity for, you know, immediately, because you do want to set yourself up with someone, you know, there's a lot of resources out there you could seek opinion. So again, it's your mindset of wanting other people's opinions so you can validate those different risk factors. Because so on one hand, it's good to be convinced that your idea is right and you want to pursue and you think there's no other alternative. But it doesn't mean, because you're seeking advice externally, whether that's through mentorships, whether that's through your investors or for other communities, just to validate your idea. And so rather than asking individuals, can you criticize or can you give me alternatives, this is my hypothesis, you know, could you validate it for me? Let's have that conversation intellectually. So if you want to, there's lots of availability out there in order to reduce the risk of something failing. But if you are not willing to do that, then you are increasing the risk, but you also might have you might just be right. But I think on average, and the probability is, I would better to just seek out a bit of advice, right, over time. And there is, and you'll be surprised how people are willing to help. Mm. You just have to reach out and ask, right?
Changing on sort of slightly different tack, but still looking at, selfishly, where our members are at,
sure,
or our Idea Space members, which is kind of early stage, that those first hires, we do get it where there's a founder and co-founder and they get some investment and they realize that they can now start building their team. This is quite an open-ended question and a large one, but where do they even start? They don't have a people and culture head or lead. You know, what's that? Yeah, how do they even get going in terms of looking for that first hire?
Sure. I mean, first, I would say you don't need a chief people officer just because it would be an overhire. And I think if you are a founder, you are everything to begin with. You know, your finance, your marketing, and your people. I just wouldn't underestimate the importance of the people agenda early on. And make equal time for it, as much as, you know, the product market fit, getting the financing, and so forth. I have a belief that when you start looking to hire individuals in your business, spend more time identifying the types of behaviors that you think would work best in the organization you're trying to build. Because if you go for skill sets and experience first, I think there is a much wider pool of individuals that you could potentially hire, right? And it might be potluck that that individual has the right behavior. So I would go the other way around. I would really try to, either with yourself or with the co-founders or the small team you have, really identify the behaviors you would like your, you know, of the individuals that are going to work with you to be displayed, because behaviors are things you can assess against, regardless of where the individual comes from. It's also ways of giving feedback on behaviors. So at Paysend, that's what we do. You know, we hire based on behaviors, and we develop and give feedback on performance based on behaviors, not so much values. Values is great to have, but for the purpose of hiring, especially if you want to hire from a global talent and you have distributed teams, you know, values can mean many different things to many different people, whereas behaviors can be quite clear. And having that foundation very early on, because it's sometimes something forgotten, and it's only when organizations are 100, 150 people, then we start talking about a people strategy and about, you know, culture principles and values. I actually think it's a bit late. You don't need the same amount of thought leadership in that area when you're small, but you should still have some, right? Because surely as a founder, you know what works best with the individuals you want around and it's sort of what you're trying to achieve. So I would say when you try to hire early on, identify behaviors first and filter individuals out based on behaviors, and then look at the skill set and the experience that they can bring.
And can you just give some examples of that sort of behavior over value? And also, where did that come from? Where did you learn that as an important tool to use?
So we were sitting down with my current CEO and co-founder when I joined Paysend. And he was telling me all about Netflix and how to do things differently. And I shared with him my belief around, I always struggled with values, just because, you know, in the previous companies I worked with, it was always based on values, but it was very, you know, I said, it means something very different to me. And so we were just thinking out loud in terms of how, why don't we just do behaviors? And then we came up with our own seven cultural principles. So to give you an example, they overlap with values to a certain extent, but they're around ownership and integrity, achievement and excellence, innovation and momentum, and they all surround the customer. So although one could argue, hey, but integrity could be a value, but by the fact that we call them behaviors, we can then define integrity the way we want it to be for Paysend.
Right.
Rather than, well, our value is integrity. Well, in one country, integrity, you know, means something very different to somewhere else. Whereas we assess and develop, and performance is measured against the way we define these cultural principles, these behaviors. So it's very specific to Paysend. And I think if any organization does that, then you have that foundation. So when you scale and you get bigger, everybody talks that language. So when someone talks about ownership, they know what it means. It means something very specific at Paysend versus, you know, maybe it could be something different, and it's not a unique, you know, value or behavior, right? It's just we made it our own. It's sort of become part of the DNA. We've done that very early on, and it works quite well.
That's really interesting. And especially with companies nowadays, you can be a global company even though you're not global necessarily, because your customers might not be global, but you're working with people who are in this digital world from anywhere. You might be a software Correct. Company with developers in one country or not. So those differences in an interpretation of values or cultural differences, as you've already explained with your issue in Taiwan. Yeah, it is really crucial, isn't it, to have that early on?
if everyone was in the same location like they used to be, I came into the office every day, then I could nudge people and I could see and I could intercept, you know, behaviors or lack of behaviors. But because we don't want to limit ourselves to a talent pool that's just in one location and we want to be a global, you know, distributed workforce, then you have to outsource, you know, that to a certain extent. Because, I mean, there's some individuals that have been working with me for 3 years and I've never met them. But I know that they operate under our seven cultural principles, and some of them, you know, exceed expectation, although I've never met them because we're so explicit about it, right? So I think there is some madness in the methodology to a certain extent.
Mm. And what do you enjoy most about your job or your role, I should say?
Well, I think coming back to the my first interest in startups, that and I guess it's not maybe specific to my role. It's the that there is no limitation to what you can do, and I like that. For some, they need more guidance, or they need to be told what they can't or can do. Whereas I think in the world of scale up or startups, there is no limit because the things we're trying to do haven't been created. Because the founder came up with an idea to solve a problem that didn't exist, you know, wasn't solved before, and you just have to come with the idea, which is very difficult in terms of when someone tells you, well, this is your budget, you have a blank canvas, you're the expert, go ahead and do it. I like that. So I like the building, perhaps more than the BAU, the business as usual. And I think the environment I'm in allows me to do that with, you know, the chief people officer sort of hat that I wear. For the role itself, I do enjoy building teams. So I think that allows me to sell an idea or a proposition that we have and bring individuals on board that perhaps were in bigger organizations before or are just starting up and want to join an idea or sort of a purpose to a certain extent. You see the younger workforce are more attracted to the vision of the company rather than the brand. So that's it gives me great pleasure to bring people. And then I must say, I also get great pleasure in people leaving, although we're sad to see them go. Any pay center who leaves, we sort of do like a graduation ceremony, in the sense that if someone, you know, has seen potential in them more than they would have had seen before they joined PaySend, then it means we've done something, you know, good for the individual. So I get great pleasure in that as well. And also because in startups, there are, I believe, no limitations in terms of what you can do, I get great pleasure in seeing how individuals grow within the organization because we've given them the possibility to work on, you know, global projects, being connected with global teams, being able to develop faster, where they were somewhere else. Everybody has a limit. I mean, no one retires when they've joined a startup, so we all go at some point. But it's great to see that, you know, we were a catalyst to maybe give them a multiplier in their career. So, I do enjoy that.
And maybe the hardest. What's been the hardest part? Not necessarily your current position, but in that type of role through startups.
I guess when I come back to my first point, when a founder has a vision and has a lot of resilience and pursues an idea because they're convinced, and sometimes we don't slow down. It is sometimes a little bit like a roller coaster, so it's not for the faint-hearted, because you do take bets. There are some risks we take, and although we all learn from failure, it doesn't mean that when you achieve failure, it doesn't have consequences. And sometimes when you do the wrong bet and you want the company to stay alive, you have to cut costs. You know, the biggest cost of a startup is people, you know, perhaps after your engineering budget, and then letting people go. So although I enjoy seeing people graduate, but that's because they've chosen to move on or they've been headhunted, when we have to go through a round of restructuring, which is a better way of putting it, you know, it's hard because it is 24/7. You know, we invest a lot of time to hire the right people, make sure that they are engaged and developed, and then suddenly, because there's a geopolitical conflict, because, you know, the financial market, you know, impacts in businesses, rather than shut down, we have to cut costs, and then you lose people. So as a chief people officer, that's a hard one, and having to do those conversations, you know, face-to-face or in, by VC and giving individuals that, that news is tough. Sure, there's always learnings, which is we could have, you know, hired slower and we could have, you know, not done this and that. But that is a little bit part of the risk you take if you work with or within startups.
Yeah, I'm sure it's, you know, it's never going to be easy, but maybe made slightly easy by the fact that people have the knowledge when they join a startup that it is slightly unpredictable and volatile, and there is a chance of that, unlike maybe a career of a long time ago where you just join one company and you're there for life. That's probably a harder conversation to have with someone in that situation than in a startup where, to a certain extent, there's some sort of expectancy. So you touched on the pressures. Lots of that pressure sits on the founder's shoulders. Lots of the hires are doing what they've been hired to do, and the founder often feels, especially in smaller companies, the weight of the entire company on their shoulders. You would probably have seen some. What are the kind of health issues that might have affected or been affected by those sorts of pressures on the founders?
I think it's not talked about as much. I think we talk a lot about well-being in the workplace in general, whether it's big corporations or startups. But if we talk specifically for founders, I think because they are so convinced, and I guess they have to be, about what they want to achieve, that they sometimes don't make the time to look after their health, full stop. And that goes as much as sleep, it goes as much as, you know, nutrition, and just being able to switch off, whether that's through a hobby or through meditation. And it's sort of always brushed aside in terms of, well, it's much better to do a funding call, you know, I could do one more sale. And I say they because I have seen a trend with individuals that I've worked with, or it's generally that they don't make the time, you know, to look after themselves because they feel they can't. But on the contrary, if you even spend a bit of time and build those good habits, it's just a question of incorporating it in your daily routine. And once it becomes a good habit, then, you know, you just repeat it and you've done that. But the biggest impact on founders not looking, I think, after their health is decision making. And you do get a bit rash, and you do get a bit irritated, and perhaps you're not the best version of yourself because everybody looks up to you, either for the energy, either for the engagement, either for just looking fresh. And there's a lot to be said because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of pressure and a lot of expectations. It's like any, you know, sports person, whether it's golf or tennis or football, whether it's high intensity or low intensity, you know, there is, you know, you look after yourself. And I think, you know, perhaps, yeah, it would be a fascinating, you know, a thesis in terms of taking founders who look after themselves and others who don't, and see if you can find some comparables. But I'll have the debate with anyone who tells me that there's a downside to looking after your health. Yeah. If there's no downside, then just do it, even if it's incremental, little things.
And probably early on, you don't have to wait until there's an issue later on to incorporate it into your routine. You should probably preempt the issues you might have later on by having that routine in place, even when life is going well early on.
Yeah, I used to serve brilliantly in tennis. But, you know, rather than trying to build the muscle around my shoulder until it breaks, you know, you wait until you can't recuperate it anymore. And it's in other sports. So, again, you anticipate it's going to be long working hours. There's going to be weekends, for example. There's going to be flights. There's going to be jet lag. There's going to be decision making. So make sure you are, you know, again, the best version of yourself. Eat properly, maybe meditate, try to divide, you know, home life and, you know, the work life. Not divide in terms of work-life balance. I call it more of a blend, but try not to have different areas influence other areas of your life. So what I mean by that is, and it's something I work on a lot, and it's quite difficult, but let's say 100% of your time is one day, right? And 40% is work, 40% is home, and 20% is, you know, divided with other things, 10% hobbies, and then 10%, you know, driving. And sometimes it's just 10% because you get irritated in traffic, or it's a 10% because you stumbled. And that then spoils everything else. Whereas what you really need to tell yourself, it's only 10% of today, right?
Yeah.
And that should not impact my 40% of being at home, you know, having the patience to do homework with my kids, or, you know, the 40% of, you know, I spend my time at work and taking those decisions, because something small has, you know, then influenced my day to day. So being able to really divide that, but you can't have a rational decision making around that, or taking a step back if you're tired, haven't eaten, haven't exercised. So I think that's really important to be able to take the best decisions.
Mm. I mean, well, you am I right in thinking you run marathons, ultra marathons?
Yes. Yeah.
Crikey.
I do it not so much for the acclaim of having done the distance, but we all have to find a way to be able to think about what happens in your day to day. And some find time to meditate, you know, other go for walks. I just enjoy to run very slowly, just for very long. And it just so happens that I can do it, you know, for long sustained amount of time. But it just, you know, gives you the time to reflect. So for me, it's very complementary. Whereas I think others need social interaction. So perhaps they take a team sport. Or play tennis because it needs to be a little bit more, you know, skill based. Whereas for me, I've found something that works. So again, the advice would be for any founder that stuff, you know, find out what you need, whether it's the dopamine of, you know, the socialization, maybe not the drinking, yeah. But you know, I mean, that's okay. But just you know, it's not one size fits all. But yes, I came into the running because it was the easiest and the most flexible that I could do around the lifestyle we lead between, you know, the kids, the work, the location. I don't have to rely on anyone. I can just go anytime. I can go at any length. So I think it's quite good. And hopefully it's something I can pursue for longer. But you've got to, even for that, you've got to look after yourself. I mean, at some point, you know, if you just keep running without looking after yourself, you'll fall over. So I think it applies to in most things you do.
Yeah. I wonder if, you know, comparisons with sport, you know, sport is constant failures and maybe just having slightly less failures than the other person, or your successes slightly outweigh your failures and you've won the match. Are there any other comparisons with sport, do you think, in business and startup world?
Well, definitely in team sports, right? I think the role of an owner, I guess, perhaps coach, manager, is to put that configuration of players together, right? Which you could say is your executive team who all bring in different disciplines and different strengths and have to play as one and get them to all go in the right direction. And you can see it with, you know, the some national teams, whether it's the rugby in New Zealand or some of the club teams like Barcelona. I mean, there's a lot of case studies there where you can see that the collective good, you know, definitely, you know, outstrips any individual performance. But again, you take Barcelona, for example, they've got a very clear academy, they have foundations, you know, they have values. I'm sure you could transfer them into behaviors in how you should work. And, you know, although, you know, there's ups and downs in terms of how good they are, they're always going to be there. Same with New Zealand, or I guess some Formula One teams, or some, you know, American football teams. I mean, there are just some iconic institutions, and I think you can replicate that in the business world as well, regardless of who the individuals are. You know, it's the framework, the process is there, right? So then, even if people retire, move on, or others come, you know, so absolutely, I think there is, you know, definitely something to be said, especially around startups, maybe bigger corporates, maybe less, but
yeah. I normally ask guests about books that they might have read that have helped them on their way, or podcasts, etc. But in your case, I'm not going to ask you about a book that you've read, because you've written a book.
I did.
Your book, Startup Culture. It's essentially how culture can kind of make or break your startup, really. But how did that come about? What made you decide to embark on that? Because that's not something you can kind of do lightly.
So funnily enough, these things always come out of the blue, but it was a disagreement with my wife. So every time we traveled out of Changi Airport in Singapore, I kept looking at business books, and I kept complaining that I didn't find a book that, you know, I felt was written about startups, specifically culture. And she got so fed about it, that me complaining about it, she said, look, you either write one or please, could you stop, you know, talking about it? So clearly I did the former just to nag her. And she said, you'll never write it. You'll never get it done.
Right. Okay.
So tell an ultra marathon runner that they can't, you know, do the 100 miler, or you know, someone who works in startup, that they'll never be able to launch. That's exactly the motivation that I needed. And then COVID happened. So it was 2020. So from the beginning of me saying, right, I'll prove you that I can publish it, it took me 11 months. And I actually published it on my birthday, on the 19th of November, 2020. And I treated it as what I've learned in startups. I had a very clear idea of what I wanted the book to be. So it wasn't about sales. It was around a playbook that I could give to founders or anyone that's interested in working or operating in a startup, or investors, so that they can maybe appreciate a bit more the importance of thinking about culture and building culture very early on. And how to do it. Self-published in Singapore. I was very lucky to have quite a wide network for individuals to be interviewed in. And look, it resulted in my current CEO founder, who read the book, that he then called me up and said, hey, I like what you've written. Why don't you come to Paysend and see whether you can write a second book once we are successful, sort of, you know, IPO, and then you can say that what you thought would work, you know, actually did. So that's why, you know, 4 years in, I'm still with Paysend, because, you know, I would like it to happen earlier rather than later. You know, you don't want 10 years between your two books. But that's, you know, how it came, really. Just a disagreement on something very small. And then I think, again, it just consolidated my belief that I had before that, and maybe it sounds cliche, right? But there is always a way, to a certain extent, if you have an idea, that you can actually then create something from nothing. And the book, you know, has my name on it. It's my writing. I've got a product, to a certain extent. People can buy it. I can pass it on. And it will just stay there forever. Although I'm not allowed to mention the book at home or have any copies because, you know, a little bit
told you so.
A little bit sick and tired of, you know, seeing that orange book lying about. And I do get a bit of stick at work as well. But I think, you know, for me, it's more the testament of, you know, if there's something you do want to do, you know, and it's a great example for founders, that if you plan it, surround yourself with the right individuals, which I did for the publishing. I've never done that before. Some editing as well, the social media. It's all possible. But I wasn't so worried about the how and the what, because the why was very clear. I needed that book because we were returning back to the UK. I didn't want a CV. You know, I wanted to share my book to potential employers or individuals that could employ me as advisory. And I guess it sort of worked in that
sense. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're not on the podcast to promote it. It's just that we've got that book in one of our Idea Space offices, and it's read and incredibly useful to a lot of the members. So
great to hear.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to touch on it. And actually, just on that, where can people maybe find it?
It's on Amazon. Okay, so Startup Culture, Your Sustainable Power for Growth. It's on all Amazon websites, .com or .co.uk. There were limited editions of hard copies, but they're all gone.
Right.
So if you find one, you know, that's good.
There you go. Excellent. And I know you work with a lot of startups and various programs as an advisor, mentor, etc. Can you tell me a little bit about one of the programs that you work with, the Women and Change Network?
Yes. So that is something very close to my heart. Because I really want to get involved more in the networking of, let's say, professional networks for women. But it shouldn't be exclusive to women. I think the overall sort of objective is that to be a real blend between, you know, all genders to come together to really push forward the agenda of the advantages regarding diversity, you know, equity and inclusion. But it's a great starting point. Women in Change was launched 12 months ago. I think they've grown tremendously in the last 12 months. And it's all around bringing women together in order for them to better manage and deal with change. Because I think in this day and age, and if you look going forward into the future, change is a constant. And being able to react to change because you haven't planned it, losing your job, a loss at home, it's important to be able to deal with that. So I think there's a lot of change around that, but also just to manage your career, taking those big career decisions. As you said, not everybody does 20 years in the same organization anymore. And especially if you work in startups, you will change companies quite a lot. How do you manage that change? So one is discussing around being reactive, being proactive, and giving those opportunities. And yeah, it's really a network I support, I promote. There's the first Women in Change Awards, which are happening in June, and which I'm participating in. And it's one of the initiatives I would recommend listeners just to join, especially if you are in a founder in startups and want to get a different perspective. I think it's really helpful.
Great, thank you. And in terms of finding it online, it's just
a Women in Change. Very straightforward. Yeah.
And in terms of you yourself, if people want to follow you or are you on social media?
LinkedIn. So Alexander Nikolaos, LinkedIn is the only social media platform I use. Although there's been a lot of advice, you should be on all of them. Yeah. I think you pick one and you just double down. So yeah, I primarily use LinkedIn if you want to keep up to date with what's happening at Paysend, what's happening with startup culture, or what's happening with my other involvements in other networking communities.
Actually, on that, just asking you about about LinkedIn and the importance of it. Do founders kind of sell themselves enough early on, do you think? Or
so I think they could do more. There is again, I think, a lack of time just because they feel other areas are more important. Again, the funding and the technology, the engineering and so forth, making sure you get the right investors. But you should carve out some time, especially at the beginning, because it's like compound interest. Although it's incremental small steps, every post we do for Paysend, every post I do for sort of startup culture, even if it's once or twice a week, it just accumulates. And I think it also allows you to get feedback on your storytelling rather than doing one post every 6 months. It'll get lost in LinkedIn anyway. So the more you do it, the more you engage with the audience, the more comments you get. And actually, it's also a great testing tool for getting feedback from individuals when you're out there and sharing your opinion. I think sometimes founders don't want to be out there because they like to be under the radar a little bit because they don't want to be here and, well, that will never work, or you're going into the wrong market. But it's actually a great place to be, again, to get that to get that feedback. So I would. And it's also a way to attract individuals to your company, because I think the founder plays a big part in why someone should join a startup, because they are the main driver behind it. So knowing about the individual, what they do, what are their hobbies, it doesn't have to be everything about their private lives, but at least what is their leadership trait, what do they believe in, why have they started this business. Now, knowing that about a founder, I think, would make me more interested in joining a business, right? Because it's driven by that. So I would say the more you can, not Instagram branding, but a professional branding on LinkedIn around the reasons you've started the business and what you believe in, I think is very powerful.
And just to be seen and be able to contact you somehow, I mean, it looks like at least two of your jobs have been connections where you've contacted the founder or the founder's contacted you, and that can happen in this digital era that we live in.
And the ones before that as well, maybe not directly through LinkedIn, but through networking.
Yeah.
I mean, LinkedIn is, the carbon copy of the previous networking events, because anytime someone posts an opinion, but you posting a comment, it's really as if you saw the person in the room and you were having a conversation, you're all giving comments. It's just everybody can see it, even if you don't attend. So I would treat LinkedIn as just the big networking fest.
Yeah, absolutely.
that happens 24/7.
Yeah. Well, Alex, we've actually run out of time, which is a shame in some ways, but not in others, because there are so many other things that we could talk about, and it'd be maybe great to have you on again, and we can really touch on some other things and delve into some other things regarding people and culture, which is clearly one of the most important pillars of startup. So thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting talking with you and hearing some of your experiences, and it would be great to have you back. And to any listeners, obviously you've got LinkedIn, so can be reached. And I'd also recommend you all to have a read of the book. Oh, there you go. It could be an audiobook.
I think there is somewhere there's someone who's read my book out loud.
Great.
Could find it. If you're lucky enough, tell me, because I haven't seen it yet.
Listen and read it. Alex, thanks again.
Now, thank you for having me.
Cheers. For more information or any inquiries about joining Ideaspace, please contact us via ideaspace.cam.ac.uk or via any of our social media channels.